session number 11928, rule 9.
Mr. Ian Fraser, real 9.
So, knowing a little bit about the ways of the African, I said, who is the chief man? Head man, or whatever he was, and I finally found one. And I said, look, I can't order you off the truck. You've got to treat these people with the respect they expected. This is the thing. You couldn't say, oi, off. That wouldn't have made any difference. They would have sat there. So I said, look, if I buy you a cow, or give you the money to buy you a cow, would you then go? Because I've got to get my game back. And of course, I always carried a small float with me that the company allowed me for expenses in ready cash. Those checks were no good to those guys. And there's a lot of yakety yakking went on and talk. And somebody in very, very good English said, well, in Swedish said, Billy, which is two. So I said, right, two, done. Gave them the money for the two cows, and they trooped off. A lot of shouting from Tom Woodruff round the bush. Oi, you lot, our lot, come back, come back. Abdullah, come back. Simon, come back. So and so, and faces appeared in the bush. Have they gone, sort of thing, in Swahili? And that's how we got rid of the Maasai. But I'll never forget that. They all tribes are really scared of them. But the Mau Mau was, as I say, they killed off more of their own, and it was just hate against the European. It started, and as far as I know, it's still going on.
Do you think the hate against the European was justified on the part of the Kikuyu?
Well, yes, in a way, to be honest. I do think that they took the best farming land from them and didn't give them any recompense, just said, we're Europeans, we're taking over. There must have been a lot of that. And I think that's what it was bred from. I think that's the whole start of it.
How much fear did you go about in during the Mau Mau period?
About the same fear as I was in the Navy. You were aware all the time, but you just got used to the fear. I mean, you just had to watch that you tried not to be on your own at any time in the bush. In other words, I'd always have two or three of the gang round me, and Tom Woodruff, who was available. Never to be alone. That was the main thing, because on your own you didn't stand a chance against those guys.
Did you ever have any contact with Mau Mau or problems with it?
We did. I didn't personally, because as I say, these farms, mostly the attack farms, and they were spread so far and wide. I mean, probably 50 miles between farms, that sort of thing. But I know there was one or two of my guys that went home and never returned, and the word filtered back to me that the Mau Mau had got them, because they were working for a European.
Were these Kikuyu?
Yeah.
Did you go right into the Mau Mau areas?
Yes, I did that famous climb up Kilimanjaro, where you all meet in a party, and you go in stages to the top. It's a day up and a day down. Very, very interesting. But that was in a party again, of course. But basically, in the work side of it, I was always with the big gang, or close to them, or in my office, and that was close to the work side. So really, you see, nobody saw the darn people. They were invisible. They'd swoop and gone. Very few people have come in contact with them at all, the Mau Mau themselves, because they had their own leaders and subsection leaders right down It was a very efficient outfit, very well run.
What about Jomo Kenyatta? Did you come across him at all?
Oh, yes, I met that guy. That was he along with Kamathi were due to be executed, and they executed Kamathi, and on some technicality he got off, and he was known as Bwana Mzee, and then of course he became president, and they were co-leaders of it. I think it was all political, really. They made him president, Kenyatta.
There was a story you were telling me earlier yesterday about a tree which was struck by lightning. Could you repeat that?
Yes, well, it it was something that happened, or something somebody said, and apparently it was to do with a Magumo tree. Magumo is a fig tree, and the witch doctor apparently said that if Kamathi was hung, and this tree would die. And a few days after the tree was struck by lightning. Simple as that. That was in the Aberdares, where the gang sort of used to hang out. But the actual Mau Mau seemed to wound it up in 1957. That was the date given for the beating of the Mau Mau, although I think they still exist in myself in a small way.
Why do you think that Mau Mau never spread to the other tribes apart from the Kikuyu?
Interesting point, a very interesting question. They were another warlike tribe, although they were the Mau Mau, the Maasai, I should say, were a warlike tribe, but that was only between them. They had a different philosophy in life altogether. The Mau Mau were more cunning. They got a lower grade of intelligence. That is only my opinion. If the Maasai attacked, they attacked openly for a reason. Now, if you take the reason of the Mau Mau, the Kikuyus, for attacking Europeans was because they'd taken their land, they would never attack it frontally. They would steal down at night through the grass and murder the women, and when the chap was away going round the farm on a horse or something like that. So you've got two different types altogether. That's all I can. Like in every country in the world, you've got different peoples, and you've got, in the old days, the Scots used to act differently to the English, and the Welsh differently. No, that's the sort of thing I'm getting at. It's funny how much you don't realise what is going around you when you're there, but you are conscious of it because of the police notices: don't leave your guns about, and don't be on your own if you can help it, and husbands shouldn't leave wives, and all the rest of it. Unattended, and more than that, I can't really say.
You didn't make it clear earlier, I don't think, the circumstances under which you did actually meet Kenyatta.
No, right.
Where was it?
Oh, sorry, are you running?
Yes, it's running.
Oh, fine. Obviously, he was released into the public, became a member of the government. The ruling party, and his advice was taken on a lot of things, and of course any event like a sundowner or an invitation to Government House, he would go along, and I in my capacity as an engineer in charge would go along as well, and that's how I met him socially.
What impression did he make on you?
A very fine man, very strong man, very perfect gentleman.
So you liked him?
I liked him, yes.
Can I go back to something you said earlier about the Navy, which was about people you called stripers? Can you tell me again exactly what they were?
Yes. These were people who were only found either on shore or on big ships. And they joined the Navy for life. 12 and 22 sort of thing, you know, they'd spent their life. They had no ambition to do anything else, nor had they any ambition to progress up the ranks in the Navy. They were quite happy to have a home and food, but they were a fount of wisdom, because although they wouldn't accept any advancement to leading seamen, or they were basically all seamen. No stokers. I must make that point very clear. They were seamen, because promotion would have been automatic in some of the other branches, and they wouldn't want to be in the communications branches anyway, because that was too much effort, if you follow me, the exams and so on. No, they were quite content to be housed in the ship and fed by the ship and mothered by the captain and have the friends on the mess deck. And after the first 3 years, they got the first good conduct badge, which meant they got more money, because you got paid so much for each good conduct badge. Then after 5 years, you got the second, so there's 7 years gone. And I think the next one was about 7 years as well, either five or seven. So it took them quite a long time to get these three badges up. And once they got the three badges and no hook, which denoted a leading hand, they were just, well, go and see Stripey if you want any information. Because they had learnt. There's one thing they did learn. They learnt the K-I and A-R backwards. So if you wanted anything, rules and regulations in the Navy, you'd just go and see one, and that would be it.
Were they barrack room lawyers?
They were barrack room lawyers, absolutely, yes.
But were they barrack room lawyers in the sense of being troublemakers?
No. They gave you advice, and if you cared to take their advice, you either took it or leave. Oh no, they were quite perfectly harmless. They weren't trying to. Apart from the rules and regulations, they give you tips on how to conduct yourself on a ship and what to do when things went wrong. They were helpful there. They weren't barrack. Well, I suppose you could call them barrack room, but I've never thought of them in that context. I've always thought them as very helpful guys. If you're in trouble, go and see Stripey.
And they were willing to exchange assist. That knowledge?
Oh, yes, assist in any way. That was their life, to help. Any young chaps didn't know this. Instead of ignoring them, like some other people would, other petty officers or chiefs, the youngsters coming in, they would go out their way to help. I met very, very many of them. I can give you one example of their wisdom, if you like. When I was taking passage home on the Newcastle, they had messing on there. There's 12 chaps to a mess at one table. That was the mess, and there was the what they called the killick of the mess. Well, this guy, this Stripey, was in charge of this mess, although he wasn't a killick as a leading hand, by the way, leading rate. He was in charge of it by his his superiorities, his time in the Navy. He was in charge of the mess. Now, they were allowed more or less to pick their own watches. They didn't, when they'd done that, got the three stripes up, they didn't do any night watches. They did either mornings or afternoons. They had to do a watch, obviously, to earn the living. But they didn't do any dog watches or middle watches or morning watches, which is the they just did the forenoon 8 till 12 and the afternoon 12 till 4. And this guy, this on this trip, was on the 8 till 12. He was actually on watch. But you were allowed so much rum each day, and this had to be collected in a rather large bucket, which they were calling in the Navy fannies, just an oval bucket with a handle. This is what he told me. He said, you are going to collect it for me, because you're a leading hand, and he says you can collect it for me. But he said, you get it always when you go up to the area where it's being served, the grog department. You get at the back of the queue. Never ever get anywhere but at the back of the crew.
Of the
queue. So I said, any reason for that? He said, you'll see. You'll see. My friend, he said, I'll show you. Been in the Navy a long time, you know. I said, all right. Right, so I'd be. Julie got at the back of the queue the first day. Of course, it was a long time. The food was all snaffled, gone. Right, lads, anybody for rum? No, we don't. We don't want any of that now. Straight over my shoulder, Pierce Striper coming off his forenoon watch. Right, what did I tell you? He says, right, let's get bottling that. And the rest of that trip, I spent in the hammock netting. Prior to that, I'd reported to the chief of the telegraphist in the wireless office, and I said, can I do anything? Chief said, don't want you, passenger. He said, go and get lost. Lose yourself in the hammock nettings every day. Fine, I didn't mind. That's passenger. And this is exactly what Stripey and myself did. The hammocks were taken down at night, and they had grates and nettings in various parts. You could get inside them and go to sleep. Well, that was it. Nobody missed you, because he was off watch. Nobody wanted to know me. And we used to snaffle this rum and drink what we could, and then bottle the rest, and it went. What he did with the rest, I don't know. I suppose he sold it for perks. But that is very true. Now, that's the sort of wisdom they acquired. Serve the rum after the people have eaten, and they don't. And this is very true. How many people will drink much? I mean, you don't drink, you said. But you can imagine, if you've got a full tummy, you don't want to drink. It follows. You drink as an aperitif. Now, rum was a very good aperitif. But after you've ate, you didn't want it. It was too sweet.
You implied there that they got certain privileges by having the pick of the watches.
Yes, they did. It was an accepted fact that they didn't, chief petty officer, they were another lot. They didn't do night watches, except, of course, on convoys, they would, the action stations. But normally, a chief petty officer or a stripey only did dates, and days are from 8 till 4 o'clock, in 2 4-hours.
You also implied, when you were talking about them earlier, that they were, in a sense, dependent on the Navy.
Yes, they
were.
They
become regimented, in a sense.
They did. They became so steeped, imbued, any word you want, in naval routine. I often think to myself sometimes, what happens to those poor guys when they finally, they say the time's up, out, they've got no home to go to, nothing. They've got nothing ashore at all.
The
Navy was their life, yes. And they were salt of the Navy. I mean, okay, they knew the rules and regulations. I'm not saying all of them did, but some of them did. But they weren't troublemakers. They were helpful. I mean, if you've got a troublemaker on board, the first thing a commander does is get shot at him, the commanding officer, is get rid. And I've never known a stripey got rid of yet. A captain, not on our ship, but a captain on another ship, asked the advice of a stripey on a certain matter. Why not? The guy had got years of experience. The captain was quite a young lieutenant, or a sub-lieutenant, and he asked the stripey advice, and he got it.
Would they always be unmarried men?
Mostly. I've only met one who was unmarried in the whole time I knew the Navy, and he was shore-based in one of the Devonport, somewhere like that. And he was the only one, and he had got a wife and family, sure, yes, but most of them were single.
Do you think that necessarily went with the whole attitude which they had, being unmarried?
Yes, I do, quite frankly. They got nothing outside the ship. Oh, yes, they go ashore with their friends for a pint at night. That was their life, the ship, the canteen, the a little bit of conviviality ashore. But that's all I can say. It's the ship was their life. The captain was their mother and father, and he was provider of all things for them: the ship, the food, the bed.
But you've also implied that the Navy depended on them in some sense.
The Navy tolerated them. I mean, it had to have. I mean, there weren't an awful lot of them on a ship. They on a big ship, you'd probably have, for each mess, you'd only have one, and perhaps two dozen messes on a big ship. So you probably 30 on a big ship of 2,500. So it wasn't an awful lot about.
But they provided some kind of essential service to the Navy.
Well, they did these watches. They did the actual watches, the seaman's watch. I mean, they were all seamen, as I say, so they'd be lookouts or whatever. They had to do their watches. But they were excused night duties.
But in a sense, you said, in a sense, they were the salt of the service. You implied that...
To us personally, the younger people who relied on their advice...
To the younger people rather than to the Royal Navy itself.
Well, I think the Royal Navy itself had a great lot of respect for them. There's always cropping up in books what Stripey did and what Stripey didn't do, and most of these books I read are written by ex-commanding officers. So I should say that, you know, they held the respect of everybody. The only offence they ever committed was coming aboard drunk. I think that was about the only which was a relatively minor offence, so, you know, 2 day stoppage of leave, something like that.
Yeah. Can I ask you also about the troublemakers? What kind of troublemakers would you get aboard ship?
Ah, now, this goes back to the Cape Argona. We had a leading seaman on board named Smalley. Never forget that guy. And he was a seaman, and the seaman's mess was next to the communications mess, where I explained to you we had about 13 in. And the whole... He didn't like people being in charge of him. In other words, he was the leading seaman, and I was the leading flagraphist. But by virtue of being in the communications branch, I was senior to him. So... I could order him. I mean, it didn't happen, but I could order him to do a thing if the case came to. But anyway, he started. There were only curtains dividing these two messes. No doors or anything. It was just hanging curtains, and they were coming aboard drunk, and they were a pretty rough lot, and causing all sorts of trouble. If anybody was playing cards on our mess deck, they'd wander through and bump against the table, the cards would go flying. And on the 6th of September 1942, I was on the bridge and went up and saw my friend, the head of the signalling department. He'd got a BSc, by the way, that guy. I forget his name now. I always used to call him Bunce. And he took his... leading rate, but he didn't want to go any further. He didn't want to commission or anything. He was like me. He was happy doing the job he wanted to do, which was signalman, in spite of his BSc. Anyway, I said to him, got an idea, and we knew that the captain was in his cabin, so the bridge, dozens of voice pipes all round of every department, just carefully lifted the one to his bunk, which went down to just above his pillow there, and we started talking, and I just in a general manner, I said, you know, this Smalley is causing a lot of trouble on board this ship. I said he's a real troublemaker. And Bunce soon took up the cue, you see, and we chatted about a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes over that. We split the lot, so the captain knew that what the devil was going off, and of course, we had about 24 hours before we sailed, because this was on the 6th, we sailed for Russia on the 7th. Anyway, the next morning there's a call for leading seaman Smalley to report to the captain, and he got an hour to get off the ship. 1 hour, bag and baggage, kit, bag and hammer, off. Don't want you on my ship, no excuse, off. Got another replacement from the base, and that was him gone. But that was only by a bit of crafty thinking. Well, not crafty, I used the word wrongly. It was a bit of careful thinking. It was the sort of thing a Stripey would have done, if you follow the reasoning. You know, let the captain... You couldn't go to the captain himself and say, look, you've got a troublemaker on board. But you do it another way. I mean, Captain E.R. Pate, DSO, probably knew damn well that the cover was off that boy's pipe and we were doing it deliberately. But the fact is, we'd done it in proper channels, put it that way. We'd done it through official channels. We'd done it through our official channels. We'd let the captain know exactly what was happening. And he was off the ship the next morning. So you've got a good skipper again, haven't you?